Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Craig Parkinson, and this is the Two Shot Podcast. Pop the kettle on and let's dive in. How the devil are you? Well, there's only six more times I'll be asking you that. But right now, I'm asking it again. How are you? Is everything good? Are you well? Good. So, here we are. The last six episodes of the Two Shot Podcast after a six-year run. And we're going out on a high. We've got some great guests coming up to you before Christmas. I think you're going to like it. I really hope you do. We've got actors. We've got writers. We've got a comedian. And that's all I'm going to tell you. So each week, you're going to have new, fresh, interesting conversations. But then the finale, the very last Two Shot Podcast, is going to be something special. It's going to feature two people that you've heard before, and I'm not going to say anything else because I'm recording it this week. I'm jumping in the car and going somewhere, and I can't tell you where. I'm very sorry. But let's get into it. So that's where we are now. I'm recording this in my living room at the moment, but last week I went to London. I went to the Two Shot spiritual home in London, Soho, to Maison Bateau. Big shout out to Tanya, who over the years has always let us record there when she can. Guests like it. We hear the chink of china, teas being stirred, cakes being eaten. But more importantly, we get down to fantastic conversations with people. So last week, I went to go and meet the brilliant author, writer, journalist, Mr. Neil Forsyth. Now, if the name doesn't spring to mind any of his work, let me tell you, this is the guy from Dundee that created the fantastic character, an entrepreneur and cheeseburger van owner, Bob Servant, brilliantly brought to life by Brian Cox. If you watched The Gold recently with past TSP guest Jack Loudon, that's Neil's work. Mark Bonner is a past TSP guest. He starred in the groundbreaking series, I will say it, groundbreaking, award-winning series, Guilt, which is all available on iPlayer now. There's three seasons. You have got no excuse on these cold winter nights not to get stuck into Guilt first, then move on to Gold, and then go out, buy the new Bob Servant book that we speak about, and tune in to the radio show. Anyway, there's loads of ground that we cover in this conversation. Neil is fantastic company, as ever. It was slightly emotional, I must admit, to start the last run of six, knowing that I've got pretty much all but one lined up, and there's loads of people that I just couldn't fit in because of time restraints, because we've got six episodes to get out and then it's done. I'm not going to wang on too much because I might cry. So let's go to Maison Bateau. Let's go to London, Soho, and let's meet Mr. Neil Forsyth. This is the first of the last of the Two Shot Podcast. I'll see you at the end. And here we are in London, the spiritual home of the Two Shot Podcast. You may hear rubbish trucks outside because they're cleaning up stinky Soho. And I'm here with my early morning guest, Mr. Neil Forsyth. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming this early.
It's good to be here. I'm very aware that your magnificent podcast is winding down.
Well,
you're
yeah.
spunking one of your last guests.
It's for a writer. I mean, I don't know if I would choose that choice of word.
This is like it's like it's Parky's last show.
Yeah,
everyone's expecting Billy Connolly. And you bring on the crankies.
Well, we've got stories about the crankies.
I'd love to see.
Everybody's got stories about the crankies, I'm sure you have.
It's a two-parter.
Now, usually I start in a certain way about choosing questions, but I'm going to start differently. I thought I'd start with a joke. That's a ballsy move, isn't it?
Brave.
I'm reading a book at the moment by Bob Cryer about the genius of Barry Cryer. Mm-hmm. And there's a tenuous link, which we'll go on to. So should we start with a joke?
Please do.
So let me get my readers on right there. So here we go. A man says to the doctor, he says, I think my wife is going deaf, but I don't want to mention it because it might seem tactless and insensitive. Is there a way I can find out without her knowing? And the doctor replies, there is, and it's quite easy. Choose a moment when she has her back to you, say something in a normal voice, and if she doesn't answer, move a few steps closer and say it again. Now keep going until you get an answer, and then you'll get a good idea about the state of her hearing. So, the man comes home from work and he sees his wife standing with her back to him in the kitchen. He says, what's for dinner? No answer. So he moves a few steps closer. What's for dinner? Again, nothing. He moves in again. What's for dinner? Still nothing. By now, he's practically right behind her, so he tries one more time. What's for dinner? She turns around and says, for the fourth time, chicken. Come on. Is that a way to start a podcast or what? The genius of Barry Cryer. And the reason I started with him is I'm just about to start the chapter where he begins working with Morecambe and Wise.
Yes.
Now, where did your love of Morecambe and Wise first start?
Well, so firstly, I know Bob Cryer, Barry's son, who wrote that book. Mm. It's a great book. Bob's a good pal of mine. And I met Barry when I was researching Eric Ernie and Me. But no, Morecambe and Wise, I mean, obviously the shows were fantastic and it was brilliant working with that material. But my way in was actually Eddie Braben was the writer. So I read Eddie Braben's book, the book What I Wrote, which is fantastic. It's really good fun, but it's really interesting about the writing process as well. He's very honest about the challenges he faced.
Yeah.
So I just found his book really interesting and I thought, could that be a way into telling the story of Morecambe Wise through the eyes of the writer and you know, things, good, dramatic things happen, which is important as well
in
that relationship. So, yeah, I loved doing that. It was a really important step for me. It was the first 1 hour I did, more drama-ish, if you like. So it was very happy memory of making this.
But there was a certain time quite a while ago, because this was like, what, 2017?
Yeah, probably around that, yeah.
And there was a tendency to have sort of well-known comedians playing sort of past comedians, but you didn't do that. You chose to have incredible actors who had sort of comic chops, but also deep dramatic chops as well with that. Were you ever forced into... Would we think X, Y, and Z should be playing sort of these iconic sort of comic characters?
No, I don't think so. Probably because the nature of the script, that it was quite dramatically led, I think.
Yeah.
And it needed to feel that depth and nuance of performance. And also we cast it, so we had tapes to show them. So we said, look, how could you not cast X, Y, or B sort of thing?
Yeah.
So it was, Mark Bonner played Eric Morecambe.
Absolute blinder. Yeah. I mean, both him and Neil together, the partnership that we never knew we needed on telly, really, wasn't it? It was brilliant.
Yeah, they were, and the Stephen Tompkinson said,
absolutely.
It was brilliant. I really, it's one, you know what it's like sometimes watching stuff you've done can be a bit awkward or can remind you of things that you wish you'd done differently. But that's something I can just watch because I think it was well realised, brilliantly acted, but it was just a very happy experience for me as well.
Are you good at going back and do you go back and watch?
Not hugely, to be honest, no. I think I was, you know, such a... Like Bob Servant, for example, was the first television show I ever made. Now, the first episode of Bob Servant was the first script I'd ever written.
Was it?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, and I think that's both thrilling and exciting, but also I think sometimes you can tell that when you watch it. I was just I was a very raw developing writer, and there's great performances in there and things I like, and I enjoy watching the show because remembering making it back in my hometown of Dundee and things. But I definitely can see my progression as a writer through things I made, which makes it often not wholly comfortable watching stuff you've done before. And yeah. I'm kind of more interested in what I'm working on now anyway.
Yeah, of course. And I want to go back to Bob Servant because I think that'll probably bring us to sort of where we are now. But can we go back to Dundee and talk about growing up there?
Dundee was a fantastic city. My parents are still there. I'm there all the time. I was there last weekend. And it was a really, you know, when you get older, you appreciate more where you grew up. And I grew up in Broughty Ferry, which is a lovely part of Dundee down beside the river. Kind of idyllic childhood, really. Go to the football, playing football, cycling everywhere. And I think for me, it was about quite quickly realising I wanted to be a writer, you know.
At what sort of early age was that?
Just what I was good at, you know. It's what I was good at school, and also that kind of storytelling thing. Like, you know, growing up in Dundee, you need to have a little bit about you. So you could either be hard as nails, brilliant at football, or you could tell jokes and stories and so on. And it was the latter where I felt my strengths lay.
Yeah.
And that was something I just enjoyed doing, telling stories in the playground and at football grounds and things like that. And you know, when I was younger, we used to sit having our tea as a family. I had a brother and sister, and we're all sitting there, and then cut to 2 hours later, my dad's doing the dishes and I've still got all my dinner in front of me because I've just been...
too busy blathering.
Yeah, yeah. So it's that. And then at school, I was just good. I was good at English, and I was encouraged by, you know, a couple of really good teachers. And
well, that's it. That's the important thing, isn't it? Usually, to be encouraged.
Usually, yeah, yeah. And you know, wasn't... And yeah, Mr. Ferry, he was called. He came in and did the kind of the class that I was in, and he was just really interesting. He would just come in and say, right, today we're just going to do something completely different. Well, let's just do a court case, right? You're the lawyer, you're the accused, and you just have to act the parts and quickly write something. And he was just a kind of inspiring guy and very encouraging of me. So that was always what I enjoyed doing. I wrote for a football fanzine when I was young, and you know, seeing my name in print at 13 and things. It was what I wanted to do, but probably similar to you, Craig, growing up provincial city, pre-internet, that stuff just felt laughably impossible, the idea that could be a career.
Completely out of reach, yeah. Especially, I don't know if you knew, I certainly didn't know anybody of my age around Blackpool that was making a living,
no,
doing what they wanted to do as an actor at all. Were there anybody you looked up to?
Brian, so I used to get the Dundee Courier, and the Dundee Courier back in those days was like the adverts. The small ads were on the front page. That was the kind of model. It was a very traditional newspaper. And but then within, they'd kind of almost slightly grudgingly look at cultural issues here and there, but always through a local focus. So you'd have, so Brian Cox would be in it, you see. So Brian is from Dundee, and there'd be photos of Brian seeing this new film he was in or a new play he was in. And then also remember Ricky Ross and Deacon Blue, you know, because Ricky's mum and my gran were best pals.
Oh, were they?
The same block of flats and stuff. So that was just the fact people from Dundee had gone and done a creative career that had kind of resonated, and they'd made a living out of it, first and foremost, but also, you know, they'd succeeded, did definitely give you a bit of possibilities, even though these were different areas that I was interested in. Just that creativity, like, oh, maybe there's a path to that one way or another. So you kind of cling on to those things a little bit when you're younger.
So what was the next step for you, the next logical step? Was it to stay in Dundee and go to university there?
I went to university in Edinburgh. So I went to school and went to university and I came to London for a bit. I did all these things on the surface, but it was kind of things that I thought I should probably do. But behind it all, I was just always writing, but I didn't have the confidence to sort of voice it, like, this is what I want to do. I didn't do English literature at university, for example.
Oh, didn't you?
No, I should have done. But again, I didn't quite have the confidence to say, to be that specific and that clear in your ambition, sort of thing, that I want to be a writer, because you feel that you're 99% setting yourself up for failure, really. So Christ, what comes next, sort of thing. So but I just always wrote in the background, creative writing, but I also wrote for football magazines and the early days of football websites. I was always writing. And then, so what I did was, in my kind of early 20s, I went back to Edinburgh and I decided that, I almost made the decision that I'm not going to do a job that could be a what you'd see as a conventional career, for example. I'm not going to go and take a graduate position somewhere in a job that's maybe got just enough creativity in it that I could get my head around doing that for 40 years. So I just went back and worked in a pub because I thought, enjoy that. Enjoy speaking to people at the bar. And I think this is the kind of work, particularly working at night, that I can maybe keep trying to push this writing thing during the day.
And also the amount of sort of rich characters that you meet that walk into a pub. I mean,
hugely.
It's starting to write itself.
Oh, there's lines from guys, you know, that drank in the pubs that I worked in Dundee and Edinburgh that still go into my shows now.
Oh, really? Oh,
100%. There's a line that I put in every show I write, okay? And this was a guy that used to come in the afternoon to the pub in Dundee, and every day I'd say, how are you getting on? And every day I'd say, you see it all, son, you see it all. And I found it so funny that he said that on a daily basis, as if he'd never said it before, and if it just summed up his whole life outlook. So anyway, I've just put that line into all my shows. So in The Gold, in the first series, Tom Cullen's character, John Palmer, goes to the guy that puts the hallmarks on in Sheffield and says to the guy, how are you doing? And the guy says, oh, you see it all, John, you see it. And actually, that actor delivers it so brilliantly.
He was fantastic in that, I must admit.
So you're just speaking to people and chatting and hearing kind of stories and things. And so that's what I did. And so it was kind of all or nothing, really.
How long was the pub work for?
Oh, like well into my 20s. I mean, I kind of... and. You know, looking back now, you think, God, that's so young. But it's not young when you're, if you're 26, 27, your contemporaries are maybe starting to progress in careers, having families, things like that. So you do, you know, there was definitely lots of moments where I thought, God, is this going to work? But I just knew it's what I wanted to try and do. And it was, because I didn't have any qualifications, it was just this slow meandering way in where I started off doing football match reports for the Scottish newspapers. That was the first writing ever, which was like 200-300 words on Ross County, St Mirren, things like that. And I loved that and learned a lot about writing. You know, when you've got 200 words, every word has to count.
Yeah.
Constantly editing yourself and you're writing the story of the game and you've got limited time to do it. If there's a last minute goal, you're screwed. You have to start again. And, you know, so I really enjoyed that. And then through newspapers, I got into the kind of men's mags back in the day where they still sort of had articles, Maxim and FHM and things. And then from there, I just started doing books and worked my way from there.
Was there an end game plan? Did you know that... because you sounded very happy just writing those 200 or 300 words for football. And then obviously it moved on to features for those for those magazines that we don't see
second
anymore.
Second top shelf.
Yeah. So was it going to be... I wanted to be a screenwriter. I wanted to see my stuff on the telly. I wanted to see my stuff at the cinema. Or was it novels that were the...
Probably. I mean, I think it was slightly levels of audacity, like when you come from that sort of background where I thought, well, maybe I could do that, but I certainly couldn't do Five Steps Later. But maybe I could do a match report, you know. But I mean, I remember a moment when I was... I don't know how old I would have been, not particularly old, but Cracker made a big impact on me. And
it made a big impact on everybody, Jimmy didn't Gavin. It?
Have you worked with Jimmy at all?
No, not just, at all. I mean, he's, even when I was growing up, when Robbie Coltrane was on telly doing that, I don't think we'd ever seen a character like that.
No.
And then when Bobby Carlyle came on, that was such a huge impact. To this day, I know now when you see the top 50 shows of all time in the UK, it's there.
Yeah.
It will always be there because it had such a profound effect and inspiration for writers and actors and directors. You
just
know?
Brilliant. Just so good and so such a rich character and funny as well when he
did. And flawed.
Yeah.
Super flawed.
Yeah. And unashamedly so.
Yeah.
So there was a moment when I was watching that when I was, I don't know how old I would have been, not particularly old, maybe around 20. And there was an episode where Fitz's mum had died and... He hadn't shown any overt emotion. And then he went to her house and I think it was a calendar or a poster on her wall had come away at the corner. and he lifted it to put it back, and there's the blue tack there with her fingerprint on it, and that's when he showed emotion. And I just thought, I had this real moment of like, someone's written that, you know, someone's thought about that moment and how to convey it, and there's not even any dialogue, and, you know, to how to capture that human experience through a kind of microcosm.
Wow.
And just thinking, Christ, that just sort of blew me away. And so I think writing television was probably always the hopefully end ambition, but as a standing start, that's ludicrous. Whereas I could get my way in through these other areas.
Because it's one thing writing 200-300 words for football because you're writing what you're seeing.
Yeah.
So it's all factual. But I'm starting to think that the confidence is building through writing the football stuff and the factual sort of features.
Yeah.
That when was it right? I'm going to start writing what's going on in my own head and my own heart from there.
If I'm honest, that would probably been guilt, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, I think
that far ahead?
I think so. I mean, it was like, you know, I wrote a book called Other People's Money. My first book was about a credit card fraudster called Elliot Castro, a young Scottish guy. And that was, there's definitely some of my childhood and younger experiences that went into his story in that book. And then I wrote a couple of novels, which I'm very pleased with, but, you know, they're very much their own escapist stories in themselves. And then Bob Servant obviously came through the books, and there's a lot of my voice and background in that. And there's look, I mean, everything you write as a writer, you're in it. Every character you create, you're in that character to some degree. But in terms of really finding my, I guess, voice without kind of sounding pretentious about it, and feeling like that feels like a distillation of what I had in my head on the screen, I do think guilt would probably have been the first one of them.
How nerve-wracking was it to sort of pass over a first draft of something for the first time? And is there someone that you always let read sort of first, or does it go?
My wife's my script editor. So,
oh, is she really?
Yeah, Rhiannon. So she's amazing. So she's my script editor. So that's, you know, there can be some tense dinners. But by and large, it's very, very positive and productive, and she's always read my work. Right back at the beginning, Bob Servant was a guy called Owen Bell at BBC Scotland that got past one of the books and got in touch, and that's seismic that he did that, and eternally grateful for him, and he was great in guiding me into the TV process that, you know, I didn't know anything about. So I think just doing something gave me the confidence to do the next thing. And it's unbelievable how much confidence is part of it, isn't it, when you're young, working in the creative industries and anything. It really is. It's like and the thing is, part of that's logical and correct. You know, people talk a lot about kind of imposter syndrome, and I understand that, and I understand people that might have that. But for whatever reason, but with me, I think that what I had in the early part of my career was actually an entirely logical and accurate recognition of the fact I didn't really know what I was doing. It wasn't imposter syndrome. It was a very accurate appraisal of my understanding of the system and my ability. So it's like, I actually think that you've got to embrace your flaws a little bit, particularly early on, and be aware of them. And I think it's much more important to be an improving writer than a good writer. You know, it's about trajectory and commitment to learn and commitment to get better and put the work in.
I think that's the same with acting as well, all the time, because I'm sure you've seen it all the time. You can drink your coffee, it doesn't matter.
Thanks,
it's kind of quite nice to hear that. But, you know, there's a fine line between confidence and arrogance. And if it tips over into that, it's like, well, we're just sort of lifelong learners, really, I think, in this. And I think that helps us progress, whether it's being in front or behind the camera.
How do you feel differently now going onto a set than the first time you went on a set?
That I deserve to be there.
Yeah.
In a very confident way, but hopefully in an inclusive way, to everybody that's there, whether, again, in front or behind the camera. It's never, I'm here. It's just like, great, we're all here.
Yeah.
And we're all hopefully pushing in the same direction. Very rarely.
Well, let's get your IMDb up.
It's not about me, Forsyth. Now, earlier on, you mentioned people who, when you were young, that you saw in the local paper.
Yeah.
One of them was Brian Cox.
Yeah.
So how, for those that don't know, we do need to talk about Bob Servant and also where your collaboration, because there's been a few with Brian Cox star. And when you were writing Bob Servant, loads of questions here. Did you have him in mind? Because obviously when people who know Bob Servant now, when you say it, that's that, don't think of Mickey Mouse, don't think of Bob Servant, Brian Cox comes in, yeah.
Take the last question first. So it's funny when I wrote... So Bob Servant is
yeah, we've got to explain who he is.
Oh, God, I mean, that would take the rest of the podcast. In short, he's a fictional character I created first in a series of books where he's a Dundee cheeseburger van Svengali, that's how he describes himself, and he's a local man done good and sees himself as a great kind of hero of the people, if you like. So, but the first book I wrote, Bob Servant book, which was when I was exchanging emails with spammers, genuine emails, where I was pretending to be this old, slightly confused guy in Dundee. And then I wrote his memoirs, Hero of Dundee, and a few other books. But with the first book I wrote of Bob Servant, I did Scottish book festivals, usually to like five blokes, you know. And I did, but every Scottish book festival I did, almost invariably someone would say, well, I'm from Dundee, and that's why I bought the book. Someone got it for Christmas. And this has got to be based on Charlie Cox, right? Now, Charlie Cox was an infamous Dundonian newsagent, right? He had a newsagent in Monifieth that was a small shack in a hedge. Like, it was almost completely consumed by a hedge. You had to kind of work your way through to get in. And he was a real sort of eccentric character. And so, like, and one of the stories I remember someone telling me was that he went in there in his school uniform on his way to school and said to buy some chewing gum on his way in. And Charlie Cox said, I've got no change, would you take a cabbage, right? And that was the sort of level of absurdism from this character. Anyway, that's Brian Cox's big brother, Charlie Cox. So before there was any suggestion that Brian would be involved, people kept bringing up his brother. And when Brian came and did the first incarnation of Bob Servant, which was Radio Scotland Lunchtime Radio, he got into... I never mentioned this to Brian because I thought he might be offended.
Yeah.
Brian did an interview reporting Scotland, the news programme up there, about coming back to Scotland to play this Dundonian character. And he said, you know, in fact, the person this really reminds me of is my late brother Charlie. And he'd never, you know, and then he told me all these stories about Charlie, about how he used to call the VAT man the posse. And he'd say, I'm on the run from the posse. And when he thought the VAT were coming to get him, he'd go and hide in his caravan in Teeling, which is 3 miles outside Dundee. Anyway, so Brian then enjoyed telling me these stories. So it's really interesting. And then Brian, I got involved because it was all this serendipity with Bob Servant, you know. And so, first of all, the first book, Blink and You Miss It, went out of print. This little London publisher printed it. Wasn't sure what they were going to do with it. Nothing happened. And that had gone, and Bob Servant had gone, and I was off doing something else. And then my mate said, oh, have you seen Esquire magazine? And I got the magazine, and they had a feature called The Funniest Books Ever Written, and they'd asked authors to name their favourite book. And Irvin Welsh had named the Bob Servant book. Now, Irvin, who I hadn't met at that point,
right,
a mutual friend had given him this book, and he'd done this really nice piece about it in Esquire. So I took that to a Scottish publisher and said, look, would you consider reprinting it? Put this on your front cover, this from Irvin. So they did they reprinted it, and it was that book that sort of took off a wee bit and got the BBC's interest. So there was great luck with me there. And then the BBC Scotland wanted to do it for radio, and they said, well, who could we get to play it? And I said, well, the dream would obviously be Brian Cox, but I don't know Brian. And this is all very long-winded, but I was in New York at the time.
It's a podcast, Neil. We love
it's long form. It's long
we
form.
We love long form stories.
It's not an eight-minute segment, radio segment. So anyway, I was in New York, and Dundee United were playing Rangers in the Scottish Cup. So with a time difference, it was on like in the morning in New York, and there was a Rangers pub. And I went to watch this game. Dundee United won, as a side note. The ball went in off Andy Robertson's arse, but we'll take it. And there was one other Dundee United fan in the pub. And I gravitated towards him, started chatting to him. And then we had mutual friends. And then he'd heard bizarrely through his mum about the Bob Servant book.
No way.
And I said, well, we're actually trying to do it for radio. I mean, what I'm trying to do is try and get the book to Brian Cox. He said, oh, I know Brian, you know. And yeah, it was nuts. So I kind of called this guy's bluff by giving him the book, and didn't hear anything.
Yeah.
But a month later, I had this phone call from Owen Bell at BBC Scotland, very confused, saying, I've just had a phone call from Brian Cox's agent, say, when do you want to do this radio show? And that was it. So just, you know.
I mean, that's amazing, because even those, you know, those handful of people that would come to the Scottish Book Festivals, word of mouth, right? Someone had bought them the book. Word of mouth from Irvine in Esquire, and then word of mouth going all the way over to New York, and that's how it happened.
It's huge.
It fucking incredible how these things happen.
Huge fortune. And so, and then Brian came and did it, and he, first time I physically met Brian was at Radio Scotland when we were doing it at Pacific Quay, and it was just a dream for me. You know, I couldn't believe this was happening, to be honest. And then it went out at lunchtime on Radio Scotland. My mum and dad came through from Dundee, and we all sat together listening to it, you know, the radio.
And how did you feel like hearing it on the radio from on the, you know, from it being on the page?
Couldn't believe it. Honestly, it felt this. It felt to me like, if this is the pinnacle, this is decent. Yeah. You know, this is decent. I'll get my head around that and I'll go and do other things. But it was just, and seeing actors perform your work is, you know, it's just so sensational. That kind of, it's really epiphanical moment of saying, God, you write something, then they come and improve it, and they do, you know, and you add performance, which is something you don't control, and it can just become something greater than its parts. And brilliant cast, you know, Laura Sol and Sanjeev did a bit. It was just amazing. Yeah.
I was thinking about this morning, actually, on the way in from the seaside. Are you one of those writers that is good? Because you talked about the script being elevated then. Are you quite good at handing over your months, possibly years of hard work, and then just relinquishing control?
I can't think of anything worse.
That is not the answer I expected, Neil.
I think I'm experienced enough now that I am a hands-on writer. You know, I'm an exec on shows and I'm very much present. But I do think I'm collegiate, and you know, recognise the areas that I can help in and the areas that it's not worth my time getting in there and I'll just get in the way. And equally, I'm really excited to see be surprised, you know, in terms of performance or direction or execution and things like that. So I'm very much there, but I don't think I'm kind of hands-on in a constrictive way or a dominating way at all. And I've kind of reached a level where I feel very comfortable that I know. See, what's nice is knowing that you can get involved in areas if you feel that you can bring something to it and be helpful.
Or if you're needed.
If you're needed. Yeah. Whereas when you start, you're actually not allowed, you know, you're just not given that access when you start as a writer in television, which is a great bugbear of mine, you know, that when a director directs their first TV show, they're kind of doing the same job as when they do their 10th show. But when a writer has their first show on the air, they're not sort of trusted, they're sort of kept away from certain areas of the creative process, which I think is wrong.
Well, I did, because at the end of the day, it is and should be a collaborative process from everybody on the team. Because, you know, like, let's take, for instance, when a play is on at the Royal Court, and it's like a debut play or whatever it isn't, the writer is always there. The writer's there in the rehearsal room.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're all working on it.
Yeah, totally.
Because things are changing and we've got to sort of make it the best it could possibly be. So, of course, the source is there. It has to be there. Yeah. The writer's there helping.
Yeah, no, I'm just across it from the writings, the rehearsal, to the shooting, to the particularly the edit. I think, you know, I do a lot in there, but again, in a collegiate, trusting, respectful way. But I do think it's to the benefit of the project, and I do think writers, particularly early in the career, are a little bit, not for malicious reasons, but they're just not given that overview, which they should be given, because it makes them better writers and it helps them develop as a career and make better shows and everything else. So, and it's quicker, you know. Otherwise you're going to have a lot of secondary conversations. So something's coming out of the rehearsal, the writer wasn't there, we better go and speak to him. And you know,
or even on set, it's like, well, wait there, we need to make a phone call. It's like, well, if we were all here together, we could solve this problem.
Yeah.
And then also there wouldn't be, you know, choose your battles what you need to do and what you want to change.
I also spend a lot of time on the scripts. I spend a lot of time in dialogue. So I think that it's obviously in rehearsal is when it's more fluid and it's interesting to hear it spoken and you can agree in the room that things aren't quite right. But certainly once we're filming, I do feel that, you know, a writer spent a long, long time writing that script, and a kind of instant reaction on a set for if the first take doesn't work for whatever reason, look at other reasons to make. Don't go to the easy answer of cutting a line or chopping a line. You know, I think that the end, that's my very biased view on these things.
No, but I agree with you, and I think a lot of people would, because I've been in those situations before, and not necessarily that I've had a problem, but I've certainly had problems in the past. But I've been very lucky with people I've collaborated with that, you know, it's right, if the first take doesn't work, then there needs to be a way around it, because somebody, as you say, has worked very hard on this.
Yeah.
I think it's slightly easier, even though I think comedy is much harder than drama, it's slightly easier when you can see that a joke isn't working
when we're
in this certain situation or with this certain cast. And it just needs, sometimes it's just the tiniest little tweak and there we go, that's why it works.
Oh, I mean, the best thing in the world as a writer is seeing an actor take a line that you were, you know, it's a bit pedestrian on the page and just find some aspect to it. And that happens all the time with great actors, and it's so exciting. You think, God, that scene's so much better than it is on the page because they've just made such clever choices, and it's really thrilling to watch that.
So seeing, well, hearing Bob Servant come to life on the radio, did you ever think that it would be transported to the screen?
Well, it was, I think having Brian on board made it certainly possible.
Yeah.
Oh, hugely. It wouldn't have happened, I don't think, if it wasn't Brian. And also, I was very fortunate that I, that point of time was when there was still a bit more money in television. You know, BBC Four were making shows. You know, Bob Servant was on BBC Four, you know, and I don't, they were making back then probably 4 sitcoms a year, you know, which is largely gone, sadly. And so BBC Scotland took it as well. So I think the Scottishness of it, the fact it was regional TV, the fact BBC Four still made things, and Brian Cox, to be honest, all those things came together to sneak it on the screen a little bit. And it was such a happy experience making it. I mean, we shot a Glasgow, but also Dundee. When we shot in Dundee, I stayed with my mum and dad. I got up in the morning, walked round the corner to Bob Servant's house. It was crazy.
It's the dream.
Yeah. People are walking past filming that I knew, and you know, I'd go for a pint in Broughty Ferry at night on my way home. It was unbelievable experience, and really, really exciting. Some such fantastic actors in it. So it was, it was a very kind of exciting time of my life, really.
And let's just come up to the present with Bob Servant now, because it's going back on radio. Is it around Christmas?
Yes,
right?
Bob Servant is very briefly returning and disappearing forever.
Forever? Yeah. Is that it?
Oh, let's retire. So a few things happened. Brian, I had lunch with Brian maybe 3 or 4 months ago. He got in touch when The Goal came out. Very sweetly enjoyed it. We had lunch and he was very kind about it. And he'd said a couple of times, the last times I've seen him, he sort of threw away, oh, more Bob, you know. And I thought, well, I think, Brian, I think you like the sound of that. Yeah, but I think the reality of doing that, in Scotland and having to learn the lines and trying to find time in your schedule and all this stuff and not necessarily something I want to do in terms of television, but it started on radio and I said, well, what about we finish it on radio, on Radio 4, and then for the actors, as you know, they love it, and quite rightly, no, don't learn the lines, no makeup, there's no hanging around, you're just battering it out, scene to scene, I can just direct it, it's just really simple for me. So I also thought Bob Servant is the kind of man who would feel that it was important for him to retire from public life.
and let everyone know.
Despite nobody going about their business wondering if he was involved in public life. And it reminded me of when Andy Cole retired from international football and he hadn't been picked for the international team for about 5 years. And, you know, it was that sort of thing. It just felt funny that Bob would think this was important.
Yeah.
We marked his. So so we did this 2-part Radio 4 thing with Brian, Johnny Watson, Greg McHugh.
Oh, lovely Johnny Watson.
Greg McHugh.
Lovely Greg.
Yeah, Rufus Jones. Uh-huh. Rufus and Phyllis Logan and Lulu.
How?
So
did you, obviously you must have wrote Lulu in your
Well,
script.
Lulu was in the book. She was always a kind of great exotic figure of fancy for Bob, you see.
Yeah.
And when I said to Brian, oh, there needs to be a sort of love interest, and I said, well, in the books it was always Lulu, and Brian said, why no Lulu? And I thought, why can you fucking mention that before? So they're near neighbours in North London. So they So Lulu, I was just brilliant. And she was so much fun. I got this message from Lulu that said, "Oi, where's my script, Lulu?" And it really made me laugh. So she was a great actress, you know, really good. So we did that. And then if I can just plug something, because what I also did was I'm a patron of a charity in Dundee called Dundee Bairns that does food and activities for kids in school holidays. Yeah. And I got all the rights back to the Bob Servant book. So what I've also done is a best of Bob Servant book, which is called With My Head Held High, which is available through the Broughty Ferry Bookhouse independent bookshop. And all proceeds of that book go to the Dundee Bairns. So what I've done is these two things together, and then Bob shuffles off.
Brilliant. I'm not just saying this because we're friends. I'm really looking forward to listening to that. I can't wait.
It was such fun a couple of days. It was great.
Fucking Lulu.
Johnny Watson as well is back in it. I
love Johnny Watson. Yeah. What a lovely kind of man. We worked together on Doctor Who. Oh,
of course.
Good.
Of course.
He's a good fun
man. Yeah, he's great.
Now, we're going to leave Bob there, but I want to carry on with Brian a little bit. And can we talk about Brando? Can we talk about Jackson? Can we talk about Taylor?
To a degree is my answer to that.
The thing is, what I will say, which I don't know if you know, you have full editorial control. We can
that helps.
We can cut, edit around anything here.
Of course, we can.
But this people listening may go, what are you talking about, Parkinson? So could we talk about urban myths?
Yeah, of course.
So there's a show for Sky Play. Was it Sky Playhouse?
Sky Arts.
Sky Arts.
Yeah.
And it's called Urban Myths.
Yeah.
And I'll leave the rest to you.
Oh, cheers.
obviously, I'm going to pop in occasionally, but yeah.
Why you put your coat on? Urban Myths are a great, great series in Sky Arts. I did a few of them. I did one about Samuel Beckett.
Did you do one with Major?
I did one with Martin. It was backstage at Live Aid, which was great fun. Martin played Major. He was brilliant in the role. Rufus, Cardinal Barnes, lots of brilliant actors in that one. And then I did, what else did I do? I did Margaret, Mick and Margaret, which was about the Mick Jagger and Princess Margaret friendship with... Kelly MacDonald played Prince Margaret brilliantly. Yeah, and then I did a slightly more ill-fated one called... I can't remember what it was actually called now, but it was... Now, the story is that on 9/11, Michael Jackson, Elizabeth Taylor and Marlon Brando were together in New York, and when the towers got hit, they panicked and got in a hire car and drove, I think, to Ohio or something like this. And this is this sort of apocryphal story. And we shot it, and it did not end up going out because there was a bit of controversy about some of our casting, the Michael Jackson role, which was, the inevitable casting, Joseph Fiennes, who was brilliant.
The inevitable casting of Joseph Fiennes.
That's a joke, clearly. When register.
My listeners are very intelligent, Neil.
Yeah, they're very intelligent. Anyway, it didn't go out. Now, but what the public missed was Brian Cox as Marlon Brando, and Stockard Channing as Elizabeth Taylor. And those two together were so funny and so believable.
I bet.
And Carrie Fisher was in it.
I heard Carrie Fisher. It was one of her last roles,
right? Yeah, so Carrie Fisher, I'm trying to remember it all. It was such a mad experience, the whole thing, that she was Elizabeth Taylor's, I believe, stepmother. Eddie Fisher, I think that's right, through for a period. I think she was in London. I think she knew one of the producers, and for whatever reason, she wanted to get involved. So she came and played a burger bar attendant.
Back to the burgers. Right?
Back to the burgers. And it was just insane. So people said, you know, Carrie Fisher's coming to this role, and no one quite believed it. And then we were shooting, I think, in like some burger place in Essex. And she just showed up, and she had a dog with her and her assistant, and she was lovely. And then I remember we were so up against it with time. I think the director had to go peel off with a tiny second unit to grab something, and I read in for her. So I've acted like this across from her, just off camera, reading in as you do with Carrie Fisher, who's just fixing me with her. It was amazing sort of eyes of hers, and I was shaking that leaf doing this thing. So she was in it as well.
I mean,
yes.
It's the maddest thing.
It's the maddest thing. But you know, what is quite funny about that is people now see it as this great lost classic, or why was it never shown? And so I'm quite happy to let that artistic view of it melt and not show people the perhaps slightly more ramshackle reality. Is that something that was shot in 4 days? But it was crazy, you know, it was a crazy thing to go through at the time. But it's, you know, it's the kind of world you live in. And I really enjoyed making it. And, you know, brilliant performances, great fun, and, you know, you move on.
And also, if there's no control there, is there? If it decides to get pulled, it decides to get pulled.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was...
I mean, we talked about going, you know, choosing your battles then. Was there any part of you that wanted to sort of go to war about that?
Probably, but honestly, it feels like a long time ago that. It feels several projects ago. It's not something I lose any sleep over, put it that
way. I don't want to talk about it, Craig. That's fine.
I've talked about it, Craig.
I mean, I had to bring it up, Neil.
And if you mention it again, I'll fucking walk.
Now, we spoke before about... confident, and yeah. You mentioned the brilliant guilt.
Yes. I'm not saying yes to the brilliant, but...
I am, and not just because I know a lot of people there, because it's fucking great. So, was it always your intention to go to BBC Scotland with it first? Because obviously you're down here.
Yeah, down here, but I actually pitched Guilt in America with Sacha Baron Cohen's company, and just as a pitch, trying to get a script deal, I used to go over and do that quite a lot of that. And I'm very, very, very glad I didn't sell it, because my experience in America is maybe half a dozen pilot scripts have sold and got ordered, and none of them have got made. Mm. And it's very hard to get them back legally and turn around and things like that.
Just explain to me about that and speak to me like a child. I don't really understand
that's
how...
That's what they do. Right.
I'll set them up, you knock them down. So you write a pilot... And it goes out, they buy it in America. And if it doesn't,
no. So I go over and pitch the idea.
Yeah.
So you go over and you go around the studios and you've got maybe 15 minutes to pitch your idea. And what you hope is that they buy it in terms of ordering a pilot script.
Right.
So that's sort of selling the idea, if you like. So I've done that a number of occasions. And it's very exciting, very thrilling going around the studios and in the States and stuff. And but none of them have ever got made. And then you invariably just can't get the idea back. I think there's like a 3-year or 5-year thing, but it's very hard.
Right, so once they buy the idea, they've got
that. Yeah, and then they don't make it, and then it's gone, you know. So I've got, you know, things out there that are still locked in the system in America one way or another.
God, that must be really frustrating. Yeah, especially because you wouldn't pitch an idea if you didn't believe in it, obviously.
No, totally. So I'm really glad that I didn't sell Guilt, because it would have gone after that. I'd have spent 6 months writing a script, they wouldn't have made it, and then I wouldn't have had it again. So I then came back. There was then another British broadcaster who I won't name, who commissioned I think a script, and then decided that they had something too similar in development. That show that they thought was too similar, I'll tell you at the end.
Right. That's enough, Mike.
It was not a success and it was not similar. But anyway, So thankfully, I got it back.
Isn't that, sorry to interrupt, do you feel sometimes that's a stock line?
Probably, yeah, probably. And you just never know.
No, and also you don't need to waste too much time thinking about that, otherwise you'd never carry on being creative.
The biggest thing, but what they did do very kindly is just give me it back.
Yeah.
Quick turnaround. So then I had this script and I kept working on it, and I made it more and more Scottish, more and more specific. And then I saw Ewan Angus, who was in charge of BBC Scotland at the time. Now, Ewan had originally commissioned Bob Servant, and he said, so BBC Scotland were launching this new channel, and they needed a drama to launch it. And I told him I had the script, sent him it on the Friday, texted me at the weekend saying, I'd like to make this. And obviously, it wasn't as simple as that. There was all sorts of things that had to happen financially and writing of other scripts and things like that. But...
was this based off... episode one?
Yes, yeah, of episode one.
And did you have to give him an outline for the whole series?
I think it was episode one and then a sort of series outline. It was going to be 6 episodes. See, one of the great things that happened with Guilt was it was going to be 6 episodes. And then very late on, they realised they only had the money to make 4. So what I did was I took 6 episodes worth of story and crammed it into 4. So people talk about the pace of Guilt and things. That's because I crammed all this story in.
Wow.
So it's brilliant. Yeah. So then now that's how I write. I try to write at that level of pace. So it's all these happy accidents. But I was very fortunate because Guilt, I don't think with my CV at the time, I would have got a drama away through London, basically. I just don't think I would have done. But
do you think they take less of a chance, or they're...
I just probably, yeah, probably. They probably want to see people that have worked within that genre a bit more. It was my first drama, really, Eric Ernie and me to a degree, but Ewan just sort of backed me, and then his successor who came in, Steve Carson and people there, they just kept believing in it, and they wanted this to launch the channel with this. And it's not an easy drama on paper. It's not like a detective show or something that you think is going to really hit those numbers. It's a pretty unique little kind of quite cultish thing. So again, just very, so important, people believing in you and backing you. So I think the Scottishness of it got it on the new channel. BBC2 then ran it, and it was a bit of a word of mouth thing, really.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it really, talk about catching fire, it really did, sort of up there and then straight down here as well.
Well, what helped was it wasn't dropped all at once. It was kind of old school weekly release. So it actually had a bit of time to kind of build up. So like I got a 5-star review in The Guardian, but I think quite late on in the run, you know, people were finding it, talking about it. So it kind of creatively changed my life, I think.
How do you feel about that? You spoke about the old school weekly episodes, people tuning in and, you know, the slow burn as opposed to the complete series being dropped now. What would you prefer?
I'd prefer the old school, definitely. I think most people would. You like the idea that you're connecting with people's lives over that length of time. But it's just, you know, it's not how it, it's not the kind of world we live in, really. It's very unusual. Certain shows, I mean, Jed seems to be able to get it, for Line of Duty.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the only people that I know that does it. Well, apart from certain streamers. Happy Valley did the same. I know Slow Horses on Apple.
That's right.
Does the same, as opposed to a lot of other people that just drop.
Which is fair enough. I mean, I suppose they probably look at it as slightly horses for courses, and I think that, you know, I think the Gold, for example, maybe is hopefully quite bingy. It's quite fast moving. We tend to have a big finish to each episode, so I'm not adverse to it at all. It's still amazing when you get someone 3 days in saying they've just completed it, and you know all that stuff. So it was, but I think also, there's such different. So Guilt, as we've discussed, sort of sneaked out a little bit. There was no huge expectations on it at all, certainly in terms of viewing figures. And then it won a few awards and critically did well.
Yeah.
But The Gold, it's such a different beast. It's that, you know, BBC One, Sunday night at 9 o'clock. We inherited the Happy Valley slot.
Yeah, like, you know, I remember.
You've got to hit those numbers.
Am I right in saying you have no say of its TX?
No, not to right. No, and I think that's fair enough. It's up to their job.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, but I mean, you're following which was probably the highest rated anticipated show.
Yeah. I think, yes. You'd still choose that, I think. You still want a good platform. And I think, and it was a new drama, so I don't think people ever thought in terms of numbers we were going to match our predecessor, if you like. But it was nuts. I mean, it was nuts. You know, the first episode ultimately, I think, got near 10 million viewers.
Yeah.
And it's. I've never done anything like that before. Maybe never again. But, you know, that thing of people talking about it. You know, I had a few experiences of hearing people talk about it just out and about. And that's just mind-bending, you know. It's so it was, but there was pressure. That's my, you know, so with Guilt, there's no pressure on viewing figures at all. But with it, go like we had to hit those numbers. We just had to, you know, to do more of it and to feel that you're deemed a success.
But I think it was. I think The Gold was a success. We've jumped around a bit.
Yeah.
But for those people that need to catch up with The Gold, or we just need to remind people, let's just talk. So The Gold was about the Brinks Matt.
Yes.
The Brinks Matt robbery, wasn't it? Which, you know, the certain elements of that story that's been told before on film.
Bits and pieces of it.
Much while ago, but this was kind of a slightly different take on it, wasn't it?
It was kind of about what happened next, really. So it was, I think people had looked at it in terms of the heist and maybe the backgrounds of the heist, but I used the heist as the starting point, and I got rid of it in the cold open of the first episode because it was all about what happened next. And it's very lucky that it's a great story. You know, you get pitched a lot of things. I'm sure you do as well, as a sort of actor and everything else, where it's like a true story. Oh, this could be something. And when you look at it and boil it down, there's just not that much story. You know, it's maybe a film, but there's maybe three acts, really. There's only three significant dramatic developments in that story. But The Gold is a very unusual and rare thing that it was so complicated and so far-reaching and went off in so many interesting worlds and areas and brought in all these characters that it became about trying to distill it down. Even in the canvas of 6 BBC One Hours, which is a lot of time, if you write with pace, that's a lot of story that you go through. But even then, it was like, right, how am I going to composite some of these characters? Or what story, that's a great story, but I don't think it fits in for whatever reason. And it was just brilliant to come across it and to tell that story. It touched on lots of themes that I found interesting. So many brilliant characters that had their very unique motivations and positions within it. And I got I tracked down the detective, Brian Boyce, that Hugh Bonneville plays, who's still alive. He's in his late 80s now. And wasn't easy to find him, but when I did, and it wasn't easy to kind of win his trust, if you like. But then over time, he just hearing that first person account of the whole thing was fascinating. So, yeah, very, very good story to come across for episodic television, I think.
And it looked incredible. It looked high budget.
Yeah, it was brilliantly. I mean, Anil Kuria was a lead director who won an Oscar during the production. Luckily, after he signed his contract. So yeah,
got him.
Yeah, he won the short that he did with Riz Ahmed. He won the Oscar.
Oh right, of course.
And so he went to the Oscars, won an Oscar, and came back to shoot in Dorking the next day. And so it looked amazing. And Lawrence Goff was also the director on it, who did brilliantly. So yeah, Luke and the design and everyone that worked on it in the kind of arts department were. But the music was great, and the costume. It looks so rich.
I mean, it's just a classy piece of work, really. It looked like people going, yeah, this is a fucking classy drama. And even, I think, the inherited audience of Happy Valley would have gone, oh, yeah, I'm into this, because it's very, very different for what we've just been with for the last 6 weeks.
Hopefully. I mean, it was great for me writing something that has the budget that you can write something a little bit more cinematic and... It will, you won't hit a wall in pre-production when people say, "The fuck's this, Neil?"
Can't afford this. Right, let's go.
So it was great, and we're doing a second series of it.
Oh, you are! Yeah, congratulations, brilliant. With the because there was a book that came out as well. Was that
that was with the researcher? So Thomas Turner, who did a lot of research in the first series, did brilliantly insightful work. We ended up with this massive document of just research. A lot of it we just didn't have room for in the show, so we talked about it and we just turned that into a book. So it was sort of accompanying book, if you like, which tells the full story in lots and lots of detail for people that want to kind of hear more about it.
Now, spoke about the fact then that when you've got a larger budget, you're quite excited about what you're creating, the world you're creating. Is there an average day for you writing wise? Because I spoke to a lot of writers, sometimes they might get up at 5 and they'll work till like 9 and then they'll have breaks. Are you a 9 till 5? Are you getting up at 5 in the morning, or how does that depend?
I do often I've got sort of domestic duties, if you like, from 7. So I often, if I wake up at 5:30, 6, will definitely do an hour's writing. And I love that. It kind of settles me down a little bit. But beyond that, it's mornings are definitely more productive. And if I'm not under huge pressure, by and large, I'll work writing-wise till about 2-ish, maybe, and then I'm pretty out of it. I mean, I think it's a diminishing returns. Sometimes with deadlines, you have to push yourself. But if you don't have to, if you absolutely knock your pan in all day writing, you're just not going to have anything the next day, And I think that, my big thing is that longevity, both in terms of career and in terms of writing, just keep it going. So, if I don't have to, kind of kill myself one day, do a good day's work, and then the last thing I always do is I do a list of notes to myself about what I'm doing the next day. So I always know. I think a big thing is know what you're writing the next day, so you don't spend that first hour procrastinating. It's not a blank page. You're like, oh, you're half asleep, here's a list of 3 jobs to do. I always try and send myself first thing to the hardest scene I've got to write, so I try and do that first. But I just, I work hard. I've worked the last 3 weekends because I'm in pre-production and I'm doing 100 things. So I definitely put the hours in. I've definitely got a good work ethic, which I do think is really important. You need to match that to the creative stuff. And but mornings are definitely more kind of productive for me.
I was going to ask if you had any tips for writers, but I think you've just answered the question before I actually answered it. I think that's a really, really clever thing to make notes on what you're doing the following day. So you said, so you're not procrastinating or, you're not switching on.
And start with the biggest problem. I think that's the other thing, because otherwise that's just going to sit at the back of the mind. You go off and do the easy stuff. But also, I think as well that if I'm busy and I have to keep going, in the afternoons I edit, so like I'll write in the mornings, and the afternoons I'll go back, and that's when I'll go back and look at a bit of the raw stuff. I'll kind of get out in the morning so you feel you've done those pages and then keep finessing it. But I enjoy writing, luckily. You know, I read these interviews with some writer sometimes and it sounds absolutely torturous.
Yeah, sometimes it sounds hellish.
And I don't know. I mean, everyone's different. Certainly the times in my career where I felt like that is because I've been writing something I didn't really want to write, or working perhaps with people I wasn't particularly enjoying working with. Yeah. I wasn't enjoying the project as a whole, and I sort of lost my confidence in it. You know, and I've had developments, like all writers, where by the time the script goes into the network, you're kind of thinking, I hope this doesn't get picked up to series, because I actually don't want to write. You know, I've done scripts where I'm sitting there writing and thinking, I wouldn't watch this. It's a horrible position to be in.
Well, the same when I wouldn't watch this, and I don't even know if I'd want to be.
Jobs early in your career where you're on the set thinking I wouldn't watch this? So.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's get the IMDb up because it'd be good for the list.
No problem, we'll do that. I'll finish the podcast. very rarely.
Yeah.
Very rarely. I think in my younger days. But then again, you know, I say that, it's like, I love doing The Bill.
Yeah.
And I love doing Casualty or whatever it was, whether it was Holby or Casualty, I can't remember. Yeah. Because they're building blocks. They give actors, it's like rep theatre. You know, yeah. It's like repertory theatre doesn't really exist that much anymore. People don't go off to Stratford-upon-Avon for 18 months and continue, you know, rehearsing and performing in the evening. Whereas shows like The Bill, it's like you're on, bam, bam,
and
bam.
They know what they're doing.
Everybody knows what they're doing. It's a great machine. There's actors there who have been there for 10 years. They know what you're doing. You're coming into, you've bust your leg playing football or whatever. Yeah. And you just get out there because it's your first job in front of a telly. You don't know what that person does behind the camera there. You're just constantly learning and drinking it all. And I think it's brilliant. So no, in that respect, I don't regret any of those things. No,
absolutely. That's good. No, I remember one time I went to America and pitched something with Sharon Horgan's company, and she was making Catastrophe at the time. And I ended up hoping to sell something as a single camera, and I ended up selling it as a kind of multi-camera sitcom thing, a kind of broader network. And writing that, because it was a good job, you know, it was a chance to make something and everything else, but as I'm writing it, thinking I'm not doing a great job here, it doesn't feel my natural voice. And I remember Shan, who was so incredibly helpful and sort of kind through the whole process, talking about her writing process with Catastrophe and character-led, and what her and Rob Delaney were doing. And I think, God, I want to do, that's how I want to approach writing, you know. And that was a kind of moment for me as well, where I kind of thought, that stuff I'm able to sell, maybe, like particularly sitcom stuff in America. And there's great sitcom writers, but I don't think I am one. I'm more thinking about, this is stuff I can maybe do and maybe write, but it didn't feel kind of real to me.
Yeah.
And I think probably after that project and a couple more, I had this period where I thought, I'm just going to not write for a month, and I'm going to just think about what I really want to do. And from that month, I read Eddie Braman's book. I came up with one of the urban myth ideas, and I think I wrote the pitch document for Guilt, you know, from that
moment,
just stepping back and then, well, what's the kind of story I really want to write? What am I interested in? And making it more story driven, I think, than premise driven, if you like, which is what a lot of comedy can be. So
this is so interesting, because the next thing I was going to ask you is, how good are you with stepping back and just stopping? Because, you know, because you love doing what you do, you love writing, but sometimes, and I love acting, but sometimes it's very important to step back just to see the bigger picture. So because of you stepping back then, the certain ideas were just flowing in.
I think it's difficult, because I think it's very hard to shake off that thing of when you're younger, thing, I need to work. I need money. And I want to try and succeed at this. And the more work I do, the better I'll get. Oh, that's an opportunity. I shouldn't turn that down, because then I might meet them and then I might get to do that. And that hand-to-mouth sort of thing, and not just financially, but also just feeding that creative development.
Creatively, yeah.
And so it's hard to shake that off, even when you get to a point where, thankfully, you're in the privileged position of being able to step back if you wanted to. But so I keep meaning to say, right, I'm going to plan this so that when I finish that filming, I'm going to do. But, you know, now I'm in pre-production and I'm already writing a new thing, you know, in my kind of downtime, because I'm excited about this new thing and there's an opportunity. So it's, I need to get better at that, to be honest, because it's not sort of sustainable. I mean, last year, I, so 2022, I made the gold and made Guilt 3, and this film I wrote got shot as well. And it was ridiculous, to be honest. But it's such a privileged position to be in. All those years you've struggled, you're certainly not going to moan about it. But it's full on, you know, mentally like draining, working every weekend. You know, you end up doing 20, 30 days on the bounce and traveling a lot and trying to write well in production, you know, those different parts of your brain. So anyway, it's a ridiculous thing to moan about because it's very, very fortunate. I'm very pleased to be in this position. But I think you do worry sometimes that the work can suffer here because I'm just taking on too much.
Now, there's been mainly, you know, we started out with football features and then we went into radio and there's been mainly television, but you've recently just had a film out directed by James Marsh with Gabriel Byrne. Talk to me a bit about that and where the idea came from. And also, I want to talk about how you feel about the difference between television and film.
Yeah. Well, it was a Samuel Beckett biopic that I wrote. I developed it at Sky as a short film and then I did a completely different sort of biopic take on it. Sky were very supportive through Sky Cinema and we ended up in Sky Arts and we ended up getting film distribution on boards and it was shot on a cinematic release. So nuts, you know, seeing something that was in cinema listings and everything else. Not many cinemas, but...
not enough.
Not for very long, but it was in the cinemas. It was in some cinemas for some time, but it was really happy with it. It was an art house film, but it was, I thought they did a great job on it. Sort of black and white film shot by James Marsh, it's a great director, Gabriel Byrne, Aidan Gillen, Maxime Peake.
Yeah. Incredible cast.
Finn O'Shea, Sandrine Bonnaire, great French actress and things. So it was nuts. But you know, it's a very different job being an actor on television and film. As I said earlier, with TV, I'm fairly hands-on as a kind of writer, producer. With film, it's just a director-led medium. That's the way it's set up. James is a very collegiate, respectful guy, so I think I had almost as good as an experience as a writer can have in film. But I definitely would see television as the day job. I definitely enjoy that creative role much more.
Me too.
Yeah, really.
Because lots of people go... have asked in the past, oh, well, you know, you've done a few films in the past. I said, well, no, that's not. I feel so much. You talked about walking on set before.
Yeah.
I feel so much more comfortable walking on a television set.
Really?
I think I prefer the arc.
Right.
I prefer the arc of a 6 or an 8 with the possibility of carrying on to tell more stories, to go deeper and deeper. Whereas, you know, you've got that however long, depending on what your budget is.
Do you feel it's a bit more locked in terms of your role as well? Because I've got pals that have been in films and their parts have just been cut massively in the edit. And whereas TV, maybe because people don't overwrite so much in terms of the scripts, maybe that's, you're a bit safer from that, do you think?
I don't think like that, but I know certain pals, certainly, that have been in big epics.
Possibly.
I think definitely the Zone one.
Yeah.
You know, and it does happen like that.
Yeah.
And you go, well...
But, you know, I'll tell you, so this is the difference between film and TV for me as a writer. I went to Budapest where we filmed the Beckett thing, and the set was this huge Hungarian apartment that was playing Paris, and within the set they'd... doing these dummy walls, set walls, and split it up into rooms. So I got there and they were rehearsing a scene over in the corner, Gabriel and Maxine Peake, and I thought, God, I'd love to. So, you know, TV, obviously I'd just be involved in the rehearsal, but I thought, you know, I'm a visitor here. So I wasn't, they were off rehearsing. I thought, well, I'd love to just hear, I'd love to hear how they work, you know. So I looked up the side of this dummy wall and there was a doorway, and I thought, well, if I go up through this dark passage to that doorway, I'll be able to just watch it. So I thought, I'm sure that'll be fine. I won't get in anyone's way. So I went up there. And I was at the doorway and it was great, you know, Gabriel was hearing how they... And then this Hungarian runner walked over and I thought, she might be, do you want a cup of tea or something? And she came over and she nodded and she shut the door, right? My face. But that was the only source of light. So I was then in pitch black and had to feel my way back along the wall to get out. So like, if you want a metaphor for being a writer on a film set, that's about as good as it gets. So that, you know, that kind of certainly sent a message. But the experience as a whole, there's something undeniably romantic about a film and being in the cinema. And
like absolutely,
We premiered at the San Sebastian Film Festival. We went over there and it was great. So I feel that I had a great experience, worked with brilliant people, but I do think in terms of what I want to do, television is just feels like the day job and feels like what I really like that role. I'm comfortable in that role.
Yeah.
I like being across the process. I think hopefully I bring some value to it.
Now, Neil, we're going to end where we normally start with a few little questions. Oh. I probably think I know this. A good film or a good book?
A good film or a good book? What do you think, you know? What do you think my answer is to that?
I think I'd probably say a good book.
A good book? Yes, probably. Particularly when I'm writing. When I'm writing, I just like reading at night or watching documentaries. I can't watch any sort of dramatic thing on television or it infects my mind and sort of lose confidence of what I'm working on.
Is that across the board, even when you're not writing, or do you invest in a drama?
I kind of struggle, you know, I kind of watch like, there's a lot of classic things like Sopranos, Mad Men, or like West Wing that I've probably watched several times over like the over a decade, all the way through. But in general, if I'm writing at night, I just try and watch something that's completely different.
Speaking of night, Saturday night or Sunday morning?
These days, Sunday morning, I'd say more.
Yeah, true. City shopping or a country stroll?
Country stroll, I think.
Now, would you walk out at the interval or would you sit through it, interpret that how you will?
Difficult. Because often you're going to watch something that a pal's in and you have to be very careful.
So you would leave very carefully.
I'd crawl out in the interval.
And this probably, I ask this to, I suppose age comes into this. Less ambition or more?
Interesting. Probably it's less all-consuming as it was when I was younger. But the flip side is I've got to an area of working that I'm really comfortable with. So it's not really ambition to kind of go and do this, go and do that. I just want to sustain.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot about that. God, if I could just eke this out for 10, 15 years, I could maybe make another 4 shows and that's a decent, you know, all that stuff. So sustaining.
Sustainability. Are you a better host or a better guest?
Interesting. I think probably guest. I can just fully concentrate on guesting.
You, Neil Forsyth, positive or negative?
Largely positive.
Largely positive. true or false, offence is taken, never given.
I think that's very true. And yes, that's all I'll say on that matter.
Another quote, there is nothing funnier than the fool who thinks he's clever.
Yeah, definitely. What is it? I think Beckett said, and I can't even remember the quote, but it's something about, or Joyce maybe, the gap between what a man sees as his role in the world and the reality is where humour lies. I mean, that's a total bastardisation of the quote, but there's something in that. Just take that away, give it a wee pause.
Neil Forsyth, you've been a brilliant, one of my brilliant final guests, and I'm so pleased we did this. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the podcast, Craig, which I love.
Bless you. And another episode is done. I really love that. I really hope you got a measure of Mr. Neil Forsyth and who he is. And if you want to delve even deeper, and I really think you should, go and watch The Gold, go and watch Guilt, listen and watch to Bob Servant, and read Bob Servant where you can. Most is all on BBC iPlayer if you're in the UK. Yeah, hard recommend. Well, I better get myself shipshape and sorted, because tomorrow morning, early doors, I've got a comedian coming round to my house to have a chat. And next week, I'll be back with you because I'm jumping on a train to outside of London. I can't say exactly where, but we've got a sit down with a brilliant, brilliant actor. So until next week, yeah, the countdown has begun. God, this has got so much more weight knowing that we've only got a few more weeks of this. But hopefully this is going to keep you company between Christmas shopping and arguments around Christmas.
Okay, we're here to keep you warm. Until then, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been Producer Griff. And this has been the first of the last of the Too Short Podcast. I'll see you next week.
The Too Short Podcast was presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. The remix of our theme tune is by Stolen Valor. Cheers.